This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Sales taxes are going down or up. In 30 years, we're going to have a state-of-the-art transportation system. And raise a glass, it's going to be easier to get a drink in Connecticut. Those are just a few of the ideas we'll hear more about later today when Governor Daniel Malloy gives his first budget address of his second term. Today in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, we'll look at what's in this plan and ask, why exactly do we do it like this? Why a big speech to lay out what's in a two-year budget? There's almost no way to know how it's all going to turn out. You can join the conversation, as always, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Governor Malloy gives his budget address at noon today. We will have coverage throughout the day on WNPR.org, on Here and Now, and All Things Considered. Then tonight at 7, where we usually rebroadcast this program, we will broadcast his entire speech, and we'll take our show a little later into the day and do a special edition of The Wheelhouse with reaction from WNPR reporters and our own Colin McEnroe, who, of course, joins me today. Hello once again, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky. Kevin Rennie is also here. We're both a little bleary-eyed today. We were at the same sports bar last night watching the Westminster Dog Show finals. I can't believe the Beagle. The Beagle.
So cliche.
I thought it was the Bloodhound.
I switched when they didn't name the Gordon Setter as a finalist. That's it for me.
I thought it was going to be the Bloodhound this year.
This is an entirely different program. We'll let you guys talk about that off air, and I'll bring in Keith Banoff.
I want to talk about sensible shoes for a minute.
Keith Banoff is the state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Hey, Keith, you're joining us by phone right now. Were you up late watching the dog show? Is that why you sound so bleary-eyed this morning?
No. Well, I have a cold, but yeah, the dog show sounds like a good alibi. Let's go with that.
Okay, so here we go. Keith, I want to ask you first. We've got this biennial budget proposal coming from Governor Malloy, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that we're going to try to be picking apart throughout the course of the day. What is it that you see, at least in terms of reading the tea leaves so far, that the governor is going to try to do to solve the budget gap that he's been long saying wasn't there, but is indeed there in these next 2 years, while also trying to do some of the other things he's trying to do? What do you see as the big themes here for the governor today?
Right. I mean, I think the governor's going to try to emphasize the transportation plan as much as possible, because that's sort of the one thing that doesn't contradict other statements that he's made. But the time has really run out for we really don't have a deficit line. You're going to be looking at a combination of deep spending cuts to social services and higher education. You're going to be looking at about $500 million of promised tax cuts not being delivered. Now, we're talking about tax cuts that were signed into law in the last term, scheduled to start after the election, that will be deferred. And this is going to be the one that's going to have everybody going to their dictionaries, or at least the back of the Monopoly box, to read the rules. The governor is going to try to say that he didn't really increase taxes, even though there's $400 million in new tax obligations imposed on hospitals and businesses over the biennium. The governor will try to create a new definition of a tax hike, which is, it's not just a rule change that forces a taxpayer, a corporation, a hospital to pay more. It's got to be a change in the rate. And I will point out, in 2011, when the governor proposed getting rid of the property tax credit on the income tax, which would have forced families to pay about $360 million more without changing the rate, just a rule change, he did call it a tax hike. Of course, he had more political cover then. So I think you're going to see a little bit of a tired exercise in fiscal semantics, and then I expect within a day or two they will just move on from that argument.
Before we get further into what he's going to call a tax increase or not a tax increase, or what's going to happen with the sales tax, something that struck me in your story on this, Keith, is that indeed Ben Barnes, the OPM chief who runs the budget for the governor, essentially saying, yeah, well, there's about a $1.1 billion deficit in this year. I really thought that the Malloy administration was saying there wasn't going to be any sort of a budget deficit they had to close. How exactly did this happen so quickly after the November election?
Now, I remember an exchange on your program last fall with one of the governor's best fans from Greenwich on this subject. And the governor had a three-pronged argument during the campaign, which is, one, by backing out inflation and holding municipal aid flat, and we were going to get even more revenue growth than the growth that's already built into the deficit forecast. That would solve the whole problem. And as you know, if you followed the stories about 3 weeks ago when we did our last revenue test, He didn't get any of that growth. Things, by the way, have not gotten worse. The fiscal conditions we're looking at right now for the next 2 years are identical to the fiscal conditions last May when the governor committed to all those tax cuts. Nothing has changed as far as the landscape we're staring at fiscally, just politically.
I want to get Colin McEnroe and Kevin Rennie into this. So there's a lot to digest so far, Colin. First of all, well, now we have a budget deficit that Governor Malloy is going to have to close. And Keith's talking about big, deep cuts that people will be feeling.
Well, yeah, but I think one of the problems here is, I think it's the movie Tin Man, where Richard Dreyfuss, at the beginning, he goes in to buy a car, you know, and he's an aluminum siding salesman himself, and he can't get them to tell him what the car really costs, you know, because the guy's going, well, let me go talk to my manager, and how about the free rust proofing, maybe I can knock $5, you know, and budget making in Connecticut's kind of like that. You can't really figure out exactly what the car costs or what you'll have to pay or what your monthly payments are because so many variables are introduced in what Keith just called a very tired fiscal exercise, you know, of just moving stuff around, fiddling with fees and increases that are not real increases. And so it makes this keystone address that the governor gives every year, and this is not a problem confined to Dan Malloy, kind of an exercise in mendacity and shell game playing.
Well, there will be real increases, I'm sure, as far as the corporations and hospitals are concerned, because they will pay in about $400 million more next year, and the sales tax relief the governor is delivering over the same period of time is probably about $280 million. So if you do the quick math there, more money's coming into the state's coffers than going out. I think you'll hear more than just the Republicans arguing this is not only a reneg on tax cuts, but a net tax hike.
Kevin?
I think that's true. I think also we're going to have to – we need to remember Ben Barnes, the OPM secretary's declaration just after the election that Connecticut is in a permanent fiscal crisis. And that's not something they talked about in October, but it is how they view the state. And you know, the governor's come off a tough re-election, and he's probably at the height of where he's going to be as governor of Connecticut in terms of ability to control the agenda. And so this is his time, and he's going to probably want to do is the ugliest stuff he needs to do today, and then as Keith points out, then move on. But We had a large tax increase 4 years ago. That was to get our fiscal house in order, and a $1.1 deficit right now, a $1.1 billion deficit right now, says that they failed, at reviving Connecticut's state finances and getting them in order.
So then how, Keith, could we possibly be having conversations about a proposed cut, or whatever we'll call it, to the sales tax in Connecticut? We heard a clip at the very beginning of the show of the governor explaining where he's trying to go with this. Can you parse this for us, explain what he's trying to do with sales tax?
Sure. I mean, what the governor did, one of the tax cuts that he signed in the last term that he's not delivering is a very popular tax cut. It's the clothing exemption on the sales tax. If you look at the last Q poll we took on that, like, you know, 70% of the population was saying in 2011, you know, for God's sake, don't touch that one. We understand it. We actually get it. We use it. So if you're taking that off the table, that's quick math, $280 million over the next 2 years. They have to put something in its place. So what they're putting in its place over the next 2 years is $250 million, say, by lowering the sales tax rate. Again, if you did the quick math, $280 taken away, $280, $250 is given out. All right, you can see what direction we're headed in. I think to mitigate that, the governor is pointing to, yes, but look 3 years down the road and 4 years down the road, and then as the economy gets even better and the sales tax generates more, you'll save more. The problem is the governor keeps saying, look at what I'm doing down the road. His track record on actually delivering on the tax cuts he signed into law is not stellar. I do have to point out, by the way, though, when we talk about, you know, what was said beforehand, it is ironic that there was one candidate for governor who had talked about, you watch, people will go toward adjusting corporate tax credits when all is said and done, and that is John Pelto, who called it last summer. A lot of people weren't listening, but I just thought it's interesting that Governor Malloy and John Pelto apparently have something in common.
It's the first time I've ever heard that. Keith Vanniff is a state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. We've got him for a few minutes still as he prepares for his big budget day. The budget address from Governor Daniel Malloy happens later today at noon. We'll be carrying the speech in its entirety on the 7 o'clock rebroadcast of Where We Live coming up. Colin and Kevin, I'd just like you to weigh in on this. This idea of pushing around a sales tax cut while taking away this clothing exemption, it gets back to something, well, Keith and I have talked about for years and years. If indeed we need to raise revenue in the state to close some problems, then maybe we need to figure out a system in which we just set a sales tax rate, an income tax rate, fees at levels that actually get us to paying the bills. There's no real need, I don't think, to play around the edges of lowering a sales tax on paper when indeed you need more money than you have right now.
Just a couple of quick things. First of all, and Keith, correct me if I'm wrong, the clothing tax exemption, which we're not going to get, was on items of $50 or less, so it would correct. Not it would not affect Kevin Rennie.
I can't speak to the second half.
You know, yes, first of all, I mean, many of us have been crying for this for a really long time, a simplification of the tax system. Just it goes back to the Richard Dreyfuss thing. Just tell us what government really costs. What does it cost to have a government? And, you know, I mean, to me, that's step one. Step two is significant property tax abatement. That's the thing that's really kind of killing people. So what does government cost? Don't play these games. But it seems as though the drift is in the other direction, to make it more baroque, more encrusted with gimmicks. And I mean, you know, for a guy who ran on generally accepted principles of accounting, I just feel like, if anything, we're in an even more complicated shell game than we were 4 to 8 years ago.
Kevin?
This is not a simple, sorry, yeah. Just real quickly, this yeah. is not a simplification, really, of the sales tax. We're taking away one break aimed at the middle class
right.
and lowering the rate. We're not talking about getting rid of the brakes on winter boat storage or some of the other things that people have labeled as perks.
Kevin?
I mean, yeah, the numbers that Keith is talking about—you know, the exemption on clothing with the clothing tax—is something everybody understands and uses, despite what Colin's comments. But you know, I think one of the issues here. This is a fundamental issue for not quite enough people in Connecticut, but a lot of them, and that is, are we spending too much? And how are we spending this money? Not only state government, but local governments, and that's the searching examination of our public policy that we just have not had in Connecticut.
Keith, we just have a minute left with you. So, anything else? Big headlines that you expect the governor to capitalize on here today?
Well, I think we hit the main points. I will just emphasize again, though, I do expect that the transportation plan will draw a lot of attention. We're not going to, however, see a plan to pay for it. This is also something that's really not going to affect the budget much at all for the next 2 years. He's going to be laying out a plan that we really will have to start paying for in big numbers, probably in 2019 or 2020. That'll spark a little controversy because that's going to get us into the next term. So are we really committing to a plan, or are we sort of laying out a vision?
Keith Vanniff covers the state budget for the Connecticut Mirror. He's got his own podcast about the budget as well. Hey, Keith, have a fun budget day today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back from our break, we're going to take a step back from Connecticut and look at the budget process in other states. Why is it our legislature is getting a budget a month and a half into the session? How does Connecticut compare to other states around the nation? We'll be joined by Governing's Alan Greenblatt. You can join the conversation at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. There's been some big news recently for some regular guests of the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Matt Dorenzo, former editor of the New Haven Register and its affiliated papers, is now interim executive director of Lion Publishers. That's an organization for local independent news organizations. So congratulations, Matt. Kalila Brown-Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, was granted tenure. Congratulations, Kalila. And last but not least, of course, congratulations to Christine Stewart and Doug Hardy from CT News Junkie, who welcomed Caitlin Stewart Hardy into the world on February 9th. All of our best wishes to that wonderful family. Caitlin was born just in time for her first budget address, which Governor Daniel Malloy will deliver to the legislature today at noon. We'll have continued coverage throughout the day on Here and Now and All Things Considered. Then tonight at 7, when this show normally re-airs, we'll rebroadcast his entire speech. Afterward, we'll round out the hour with a special edition of The Wheelhouse. This morning, we're joined by Kevin Rennie. He is a former Republican lawmaker, and he's a columnist for the Hartford Courant. Also joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Your show this afternoon, Colin, is one that I know will be close to Kevin Rennie's heart.
Yes, absolutely. Something Kevin cares about passionately, as do I, and that is corruption. The U.S. attorney has formed a new task force here in Connecticut with billboards. So as you're driving into Connecticut, it says, hey, seen any corruption? Here's the number to call.
It's really like a great marketing slogan.
Yeah, 1-800-CALL FBI.
Right. Yeah, still revolutionary and corrupt. Yeah. But we're going to talk not only to her, but also to historians of corruption and sort of talk about, you know, what is it we refer to when we talk about public corruption, and then what is its real impact? And, of course, one question that I think Kevin and I both have is, as a populace, as a country, how seriously do we really take it? I mean, there's some signs that we don't take it as seriously as we should.
Yeah, we're not as concerned about it as maybe some people think we are. Well, it's an interesting conversation this afternoon at 1 on the Colin McEnroe Show. Coming up next here on the program, I want to welcome in Alan Greenblatt, who's a staff writer for Governing. And we wanted to bring you in, Alan, because we've been considering this whole question about budget speeches that governors make and state of the state addresses. So thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it sounds from your announcements like good things happen to your guests, so thanks for having me on.
Yes, I know. A lot of good things have been happening recently. So here's something we always wonder about, Alan. We have a State of the State address, and then when there's a two-year budget cycle, we have this very, very long budget speech in which the governor lays out a whole bunch of plans, some of which may make their way into law, most of which will not. Do all other states do it this way?
Well, not all other states, but it's quite common, really. I'm talking to you from St. Louis and right across the river. The governor of Illinois is going to give a budget address today also after having given a state of state. And there's kind of a cliche in state government. You know, you figure out what policies you want to pursue, and then you have to figure out how you're going to pay for them. So that's kind of the yin and yang of the state of state is the poetry, the vision, the direction the governor wants to go in, and then the budget address in the budget is the hard numbers, how he or she intends to get there.
Of course, here in Connecticut, we've got a part-time legislature. They've already been in the job for a month. It's a session that only lasts a few months to begin with. So the governor waits until a month into the session, gives a budget address, which is supposed to be the starting point of the work that they do. Is that as unusual as it sounds like it's supposed to me, Alan?
Well, no, not really. I mean, most states have their fiscal year starting on July 1st, so they have until then. I mean, I don't want to be cynical, but my feeling is you can the governor can drop his budget whenever he wants, and they'll get to it at the last minute, regardless. But you know, there's some states like Virginia. The governor does a budget address in December before the year starts, and then does a state in the state, you know, in the new year. But it's not unusual. I mean, in Texas, the new governor, Greg Abbott, gave his state of the state slash budget address yesterday. And lawmakers there aren't allowed to pass bills for the first, I think, 60 days of the session. They have a very an even shorter session than you do. So the timing is not so unusual. I mean, it does put a time crunch on, but you know, maybe that's what they're going for, a sense of urgency. Here's my overwhelmingly large multi-billion-dollar proposal, and I need you to deal with it right now.
Oh, Kevin Rennie, you've seen an awful lot of these speeches. What's your reaction?
You know, one of the things to remember is that budget in every state will have things in it that legislators want, that individual legislators want. So as a matter of strategy, you need to hold back on the budget. Because once it's passed, a lot of these legislators will start to roam off the reservation and become a little more independent than their leaders might like them to be. So that they do hold their a lot of legislation is held back for the last minute, not because they've mismanaged it, but because they know human nature, and they especially know the nature of their fellow politicians and legislators.
Colin?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of reasons why this timetable, which seems so awkward, happens. And Kevin has alluded to one of them. And it's also important to realize that it takes a while to generate the budget document that will be dropped today for the same reason. They've got to figure out. I mean, it's an administrative document, but it's also a political document. So they got to figure out, what do we have to load this thing up with? I mean, first of all, what are the stark realities, which Keith was talking about in the first segment, and then what's the other crap that we have to load this thing up with in order to keep people X, Y, and Z happy? The other thing to remember is that some of the agrarian cycle is based a little bit on election years, which we've just had. So after they win an election, either they're lying in a fetal position for about 6 weeks, or it's like some Baratheon party at King's Landing where they're just drinking wine and mead out of horns for a while. It takes them a while to settle down, and February is probably realistic in terms of when they could actually focus on getting a budget out, even given the fact that, as you've suggested, Mr. Dankowski, it's not a good timetable.
Well, Alan, one of the other things that this budget address may have to do, some budget addresses don't do at all, is deliver a little bit of tough news. I mean, we've got a pending $1.1 or $1.6 billion deficit in the first year of this budget, depending on who you talk to. How have you seen governors lay out the hard stuff, as Governor Malloy will call it, shared sacrifice that we all have to endure?
Well, this, again, is the reason sometimes they do the budget separately from the state of state. The state of state is lofty and aspirational and usually free of bad news. And the budget, they have to be realistic. And, this year is a sort of surprisingly tough year for state budgets overall. There are a lot of states with deficits. Basically, what's happened is revenues have not kicked up as much as is typical. Since the 60s, we sort of average 6% growth in state revenues overall. Now we're getting maybe 2% growth. And the thing that's interesting to me about Governor Malloy's proposal is, he wants to lower the sales tax, which he had raised a few years ago, but he wants to have it cover more things. And that's always a tricky thing for state policymakers to pull off, extending the tax to new services. But so much of the economy is not taxed now. There's so much more of the economy is made up of services as opposed to manufactured goods, which is typically what gets taxed. So trying to spread the tax to capture more of the economy is something that's necessary, but it's going to be a really tough fight.
Alan Greenblatt is a staff writer for Governing Magazine. Alan, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Could I ask Kevin one thing?
Absolutely. Please do.
It seems to me that this is the state of the state address. That, effectively, this really is the state of the thing that gets delivered earlier, typically, and Malloy, I think, in particular, they shoot up a few flares in the sky and then they say, okay, we'll see you in February.
Yeah, and also in this year in particular, it's an inaugural address, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to get to work. Now, there are 2,500 bills that were submitted, and then there's the budget. But a lot of those bills have nothing to do with the budget, and so they need time to talk about those. A lot. That's really the first 6 weeks is spent on having bills drafted, and then starting to have public hearings. And something else to remember about the budget is there will be, particularly when there are cuts, there will be a lot of public hearings that are crowded.
Very crowded.
Very crowded with unhappy people. And people, organizations bring in the people they serve or others have an interest in what they do. And it gets to be a big production. And legislators need to be there to listen.
Well, I'll ask you, Kevin, and I don't think I've ever asked you this question. I always grill legislative leaders on this about why we have the system that we do that allows for this compressed time frame in which they don't do a whole lot for a couple of weeks. They draft 2,500 bills, then they grapple with the budget. And then at the very end, everything gets done in the dark of night, and we spend the next 2 weeks just trying to figure out what made it into an implementer bill. Is there any Kevin Rennie plan that you have in mind that might change this? You already alluded to human nature is what it is. People will do things at the last minute if they can. Is there anything we can do to fix this?
No, I don't think so. But one of the things that you hear, one of my favorite phrases at the Capitol was, we'll fix it on the floor. So you'd have a piece of legislation. And in order for a bill to become law, it has to go to a lot of places at the Capitol. And so if there are issues that arise at a time that maybe someone brings up what's a fairly minor issue, but it's important to them, then they don't want to kill the whole bill in order to resolve it and maybe change its course. But they'll say, when it gets in front of us as a whole group in the House or in the Senate, then we'll fix it there. And so you'll hear people say all the time, I'm voting for this, but they promised me they're going to fix it on the floor. You would be amazed at what gets fixed on the floor. They should have a mechanic's license somewhere
for everything that gets fixed.
The other one was, and this was a bad one, was that there was one legislator in particular in my time who used to say, well, we'll let the courts decide. And I used to think, no, that's why we're here.
We'll let the courts decide. That's perfect division of powers. Colin, any thoughts on this? I mean, we've talked about this before, but I don't know if there's any way to ever fix this problem.
Well, you know, I've attempted, and others have too, the just public shaming of them, and that does not seem to work. In other words, you know, a lot of things are dealt with horrendously in those last 36 to 48 hours. I mean, they are not given anything like appropriate consideration. And just to be there, you know, at some strange hour of the night and watch the faces of some idealistic group of people standing out in the hall. I mean, I was watching the second look legislation people last year at some strange time of night where the bill just kind of got traded out. I can't even remember whether it was one of those fights between Sharkey and Williams or what, or they needed the Republicans on something. I can't even remember what killed it. It doesn't matter, though. And that's criminal. And watching their faces as they realized that this was a very important piece of legislation to them, they thought it had some actual moral force. God help us, you know. And just nobody gave a whoop in the high wind about that. They were in full bazaar mode, you know. They're just trading carpets for gold and just forget about, you know, the actual content of stuff. And the fact that they're not ashamed of it. I mean, you really need, you know, how Jesus comes and cleanses the temple? You kind of need that. You need some messianic figure to come tip over all their stalls and kick all their, you know, water pipes and beads, across the yard and start all over again.
I don't think we're holding our breath for that to happen. Colin McEnroe and Kevin Rennie joined me in the wheelhouse today. It's our weekly news roundtable. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Well, okay, here's one thing that Governor Malloy is going to talk about in his budget address today, Kevin, that I think we really need to grapple with, and we have a little bit on the program so far, and we will in the coming weeks and months, because transportation is such an important part of our state and our state's future. We often really give politicians the business for thinking so short-term and with narrow self-interest, but it seems though the governor is going to release something like a 30-year, $100 billion transportation plan. We cannot fault him for not being far-reaching and far-looking in this plan, because he's thinking about 30 years out, which is what a whole lot of us don't do. The Hartford Current had a whole lot of details in this.
One reason we don't do it is that we know that it's absolutely a fool's errand to try to predict what's going to happen in 30 years.
It is a fool's errand to try to predict what will happen, but how do we ever have a plan for beyond the next 2 years with something like transportation where we can gain out of changes?
I mean,
how does it work?
There's a difference between the next 2 years and 30 years.
Absolutely.
And there's a certain amount of grandiosity of Dan Malloy that we're seeing in this to think, all right, I'm going to give you this plan. Then I'm going to be out. Then I'm, in all likelihood, I'm going to be out of office before anything starts to happen with it. And I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago, is that there are dramatic changes in technology going on right now, just in automobiles.
Yes,
that ought to be considered and ought to be part of this rather than a Valentine to the road builders.
Which is what we're talking about. We're talking about widening 84, talking about widening 95. Obviously, lots of investments in rail as well. But you're talking, Kevin, about the fact that in 30 years, if we're all still driving our cars around places and Google isn't driving our cars for us, we're really going to be screwed.
You know, I'm talking about in 5 years, really. I mean, there are places in Europe and some of the European capitals where they're really technology is starting to make a difference in how you drive your car, and it's making it much more efficient. I mean, the sad thing is that the technology is in many ways better driver than we are.
So Colin, but pick up on this, because I understand, look, 30-year plan, especially when we don't know what the future of transportation is, seems awful grandiose. But I don't think that we should be taking a look at something as important as transportation and saying, well, let's fix it in 2 years and let's fix something else in another 2 years, because it's not going to ever get funded or built that way. What's the middle ground here?
You know, first of all, I'm in a better mood about this than I think than you two guys are. And part of it is because I read words today that I thought I would never read. If you look at the proposal that's before us, it's a $2.8 billion proposal. $900 million of it goes for roads, and everything else is kind of for rail and mass transit. Well, they're talking about things like extending the busway to Manchester, using HOV lanes, but also significantly upgrading rail. I think we all have our eye on that the so-called new Hartford commuter line. And the thing that I'd never read before, and I can't remember whether the Redeker, the commissioner, said it or somebody else said it, was, well, yeah, we want to concentrate on rail because it's actually cheaper. It's cheaper to upgrade rail right now and upgrade mass transit than to actually expand road capacity. In the history of Connecticut, Kevin's absolutely right. It's been one Valentine to the road building industry after another, and they would rather widen a highway than do almost anything else. But so I found that kind of interesting that they see it that way, and it certainly never gets expressed in terms of numbers because we're always told what any kind of mass transit is prohibitively expensive. So, you know, I don't know. I felt a little bit better today.
Kevin?
Mass transit is expensive. The problem with mass transit becomes the expense of maintaining it and operating it once it's built. And that is often not factored into these estimates of how much it's going to cost because we're going to find out pretty soon with the busway. Is it meeting expectations?
Yeah, and I think Redeker's strategy, I'm starting to understand how his mind works. His strategy is to create mass transit that requires the minimum amount of maintenance, which is not to suggest that you're incorrect, that mass transit still needs maintenance. But his whole idea is kind of a set it and forget it. In other words, he's not going to have terminals. He's not going to have
these minimalist terminals.
Even
busways are much easier to maintain than a rail line.
Yeah, the other part of this, though, is how work habits have changed as a huge cultural change in America and other places, but especially here in Hartford, for instance. The number of people who are working from home who used to commute into Hartford, well, let's say 30 years ago, has changed so dramatically that needs to be part of these calculations. And I don't see that more people are going to be working in offices as we move into the future. It's probably fewer people are going to be working in offices. More are going to be at home.
Well, the big problem, though, is, I don't know if there's a way to undo it, but one of the reasons that we have the situation we have right now is that we let sprawl happen both at the residential level and at the commercial level.
By sprawl, you mean allowing people to live where they want to live.
Well,
hold
on here. But yes, obviously.
Yes, that's right.
I'm not suggesting otherwise.
Yes, but socialist dream.
But you ideally want to design things. I mean, what you have now is a situation where somebody works in an office park in Farmington and buys the cheapest house that they can find because they're young, and that's in Ellington. And so that's no real plausible commute, but that's what people wind up doing. And sometimes also, there's two people in the family and the other person works in some other improbable place. So that as commerce began to leak out of center cities, not only did you have this problem of residential sprawl moving out, but people didn't all want to go to the same place. So it was harder and harder to design mass transit, even as this problem was caused by a deterioration or lack of mass transit. I mean, there was a time in Hartford where people got in the trolley, in West Hartford and came in. We don't live in that world anymore.
Well, 291 was supposed to be, a master ring around the classic ring highway around Greater Hartford and was stopped by really very, very devoted individuals who living in communities who did not want another big highway coming through.
One last thing on this before we move on. It seems as though in order to pay for this, there's talk once again about tolls in Connecticut, some sort of tolling mechanism that's not the old-fashioned toll booth that we tore down some years ago, but some sort of passive toll collection system. Do you think it actually happens this time around, Kevin?
No.
No tolls?
I don't think no.
How do we pay for all this?
Well, they worry about that later. Plus, it's 30 years. It's the next 30 years. it would be typical to start collecting tolls now and not give any improvements
lock
for
box.
Many, many, many years.
Lockbox.
Well, the other thing to remember is we have very few advantages in terms of our economy with other our neighboring states, And, you know, maybe tolls, lack of tolls, absence of tolls is one of those. And so does it mean we have to ratchet it up even more, make the cost of living
people
higher in Connecticut?
There's people driving through the state all the time. They don't even stop here. We can toll them.
They buy gas. You pay for it in the huge gas.
Massachusetts, and they don't pay tolls again
well,
until New York.
Well, then what does that tell you?
Yeah,
what does that tell you?
There's that. Colin, one last word on this?
Yeah, no, I still think tolls are – I used to hate tolls. I now think they're probably pretty good public policy in the sense of, you know, if you want to use something, then pay for it. So you want to use the road system, pay for it. So that's my last word.
Pay for it with the gas tax.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation with Colin McEnroe and Kevin Rennie. They're both columnists for the Hartford Courant. Colin, of course, has his program at 1 o'clock here on WNPR. When we come back, we'll be talking a little bit more about something that Governor Malloy is really planning. He's planning to make it easier for us to get a drink here in the state. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Sal Pina is a 52-year-old who moved to Connecticut 20 years ago, and he has been living on the streets and under bridges ever since, one of many chronically homeless people in the state. We're going to meet Sal tomorrow and hear the first of a series of stories from our own Susan Campbell about homelessness in Connecticut. It's the start of a 100-day challenge in Greater Hartford. Can we end homelessness in 100 days? Some advocates are going to try. We're going to talk about it tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, it's the Wheelhouse Hour Weekly News Roundtable. Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and Kevin Rennie, who is a columnist for the Hartford Courant, who agree on way too much, it seems, are both here with me. And we're tackling some of what's in the governor's budget address today. The budget address happening at noon. We'll have coverage throughout the course of the day on WNPR.org and on Here and Now and All Things Considered. Then at 7 o'clock, where we usually rebroadcast this program, we will be hearing the speech in its entirety. And Colin and I will be back once again to provide a little bit of, I suppose we'll call it expert analysis on the speech later on. Before we move on to one last thing from the budget, Kevin, I wanted to shine a little light on the column that you wrote this week. One of the many pieces of legislation that's out there that we can sort of talk about a little bit, and whether or not it actually becomes law is something we'll deal with in a couple of months. But a new bill putting activism under the state's thumb, and it has to do with who's a lobbyist. And this is a really interesting question. Explain a little bit about what's in this bill.
Well, this bill seeks to, clean up the current law on grassroots lobbying and what it means and what the consequences are of engaging in it. Right now, the Attorney General decided in 2009 that the law is way too broad. They tried to basically slap around the Catholic Church for urging the Diocese of Bridgeport for urging its faithful to get involved to defeat a bill, which they did. And then there was a lot of mumbling about, well, are they engaging in grassroots lobbying? They need to report that. And the Attorney General said, no, the law is too broad. So now they're trying to clarify the law in order really to start regulating grassroots lobbying. And I think it is things like, you know, if the three of us decide that we want to support Colin's socialist zoning rules and we start, we get some of our friends together and we start doing things. The law as it's proposed, as I read it, could bring us into the purview of the State Ethics Commission, and that works against our fundamental right to, first of all, to petition our government and our right to free speech. And we're not lobbyists. We're just interested in a bill like people have been for centuries in Connecticut. And
is part of the intention of it to crack down on individuals, not the grassroots folks, but people who are actually doing lobbying who are not then registered as lobbyists?
Well, they already have to, you know, if you reach certain threshold of compensation, you have to register. But if you're just, you know, sending letters and setting up a website with a bunch of people who have a common interest, it may not be that many people, and it may be a very narrow common interest, then you could find yourself under the purview of the State Ethics Commission, and they have a lot of authority to make your life unpleasant. And plus, just, you know, butt out. These people are people are allowed to petition their government without having to register with an ethics agency that, frankly, in Connecticut, for a long time, has not exactly been a model of great government.
Colin?
That'll cut down on the size of some of those public hearings you were talking about. Go get your badge, friendo.
Right, go get your badge. Go sign up. Go pay us some money.
So I know this is, I mean, yeah. Sprawl is like the only thing left that Kevin and I can fight about because we do agree about so many things now. I totally agree with him about this. It's ridiculous. Look, we know what a lobbyist is. Lobbyist gets paid. I mean, the Catholic Church, I don't know, they still do. Remember that guy Holian or whatever his name is?
Oh, boy.
they have somebody up there whose job it is.
I know. When I got to the legislature many years ago, and there was a lobbyist for the Catholic Church. I thought, well, I'm an Episcopalian. And I thought, I cannot. What, a church has a lobbyist? Yeah. And they come wearing a collar? Yeah.
But he was a lobbyist.
My dad was Father Barry.
Yeah. And so they have a lobbyist. And it's either, I don't know, those guys, how they. But basically, you get paid, right?
Yeah. And then they hire lobbying firms at the same time. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, the rest of this stuff. You know, grassroots activism. Kevin's right. The people need to have access to their government. And that means you get to go there and walk around and ask questions and stuff like that. And, I mean, we know what a lobbyist is.
Well, and I just want to point out the second half of that column, which got no attention, was about the proposal to require codes of ethics in municipalities. But the proposal from the ethics agency does not say that lobbyists must register as part of lobbying municipal governments, which can involve tens of millions of dollars in contracts and other benefits. But, you know, you get some of your neighbors together or some people you go to church with or belong to the Little League with and you have something you're interested in, they want you to have to register as a lobbyist. And, you know, every year there are always classes around Connecticut that do a wonderful thing. They'll say, you know, there's some ancient statute. We want to try to get that repealed. And a teacher said, all right, I'm going to show you the legislative process in real life. And you think, well, that teacher is being paid. Does that mean they have to register as lobbyists because that's become part of their job?
Rachel just tweets us, regulating grassroots lobbying, does this impact small nonprofits, she asks?
It would, certainly, because they would have people involved. If you have someone in that small nonprofit who says to their interest, people who are interested in it, call your legislators, go to the Capitol, do these various things that people do every day, then you fall under the definition in that bill.
Now, I want to turn back for our last segment here to the governor's budget address, in which he may address some of these issues, some of the different ways he wants to change state law. Governor Moyes made several appearances where he discussed proposed changes to our alcohol laws, and he's gone to TV and radio studios with gifts in hand.
Why should it cost more money to be in Connecticut? You didn't tell anybody what I did. I brought you some beer.
Let's go. Let's do a shot.
No.
I haven't worked out yet.
But wait a minute. I brought you a gift. You know, Two Roads is a great brewery in Connecticut, and I wanted to bring this to you because I know you're a beer drinker.
I love beer.
And I've been known to drink a beer or two.
Thank you, Governor.
So that's for you.
So here's what we predict will be playing on the PA system when Governor Malloy walks up to the podium for his speech today. My goodness. So, Colin, here's the thing. I've been trying to get Governor Malloy on for the last couple of weeks. I had no idea he was bringing beer to all of his appearances now. I can't wait to see what he brings me. This is so exciting.
I think it might have been tequila on one occasion. But, yeah, not only is he doing all that, but, you know, he's gotten 0.15% off the sales tax. So holla at your boy. Obviously, some of this is that, I mean, every governor, even in Grinch season, which is what 2015 in Connecticut is, I mean, it's just a fiscally dire situation. It's a permanent financial crisis, and it's even worse than that right now. You know, you want to be Santa Claus somehow. So this is sort of his kind of, I think, ill-chosen and ill-considered, you know, pandering attempt to be Santa Claus. I mean, showing up with booze for your interviews as you're rolling out your budget address. I blogged about this. I said, this actually is something that Royo Hilgrosa, who is sort of no longer whispering in the governor's ear, would not have let him do. This is more the frat boy mentality of the advice that he's getting right now. And it's bad advice. It doesn't look gubernatorial at all.
Colin, don't mess this up for me. I'm looking for a bottle of tequila from the governor. I really am, Kevin.
You know, for someone who – the governor who's turned out to be pretty left-wing – this notion of his championing alcohol, I don't get it. I just, they want to extend the hours of package stores. Are do people not have enough opportunity to buy alcohol in Connecticut?
As it, but you're just saying it's a free market, Kevin. I mean, let it open until midnight if you want.
I am very libertarian about many things, but we don't treat alcohol the same way as we treat almost anything else. And when you think about, for instance, the way we tax alcohol, we clearly treat it differently. And what will be interesting to see is what I'm fascinated by this. What do the Mothers Against Drunk Driving do on this one? Because the last time they supported the extended bar hours and the Sunday openings, and it's this crazy, I would say, betrayal of their principles. But they have an interest in what goes on in government, and that's what happens with a lot of groups. We often are not aware of ostensibly private groups, how much they depend on government, and whether it's through statutes or through programs that they get paid for. Mm. And we will see if the voices of Mothers Against Drunk Driving are stilled again this year.
Colin?
Well, setting aside the question of whether Dan Malloy is a left-wing governor, which I certainly don't think he is, but setting aside that question, I do think what happens in these situations, particularly when there really isn't any money to go around, there isn't any money to do anything really significant, is you wind up getting both from the governor's office and from the legislators, these bills that are about these strange things that people might want.
That's true.
As you look at the bills, one of the things that you find out every year is there's some way in which somebody wants to kill a deer that they're not allowed to. Like, they want to be able to kill a deer on Sunday with a knife while they have a gun. And they
Face the state.
somehow or other, it just turns out that our deer killing laws are not, And then what happens, to get back to your earlier point, is that bill gets traded out because it's five Republican votes that they need or something like that. So at 11:45 at night, that bill gets traded out, whether it's a booze – it really is like the Christopher Buckley book, thank you for smoking. Yeah. Whether it's a booze bill or a gun bill or whatever it is, a hunting bill, those bills wind up getting traded out against substantive and significant legislation because – John, to your point, they've let things run down to the last minute where they have no choice. They no longer have the bargaining power that they would have 2 or 3 weeks ago. So all of this crazy crap becomes key pieces on the monopoly board.
Kevin?
Well, and part of that is, I made some reference to this a few weeks ago, is that there's a list. There's a list that the leaders put together in the last few days of bills that they can agree they want. Only one of them may need to want it, and it gets on the list, or bills that they absolutely want killed. And then they try to reconcile those bills. And you go to your leader and you say, look, you got to get my bill on the list. It's got to pass. And then you've sort of given a little piece of your soul over it if you get on the list. If you don't get on the list, well, then you're more of a free agent.
We have about a minute left. Do you have a favorite from your time as a legislator? One of those things that came up where you saw that and like, I can't believe that this is something we're actually talking about now when we have to pass a budget at the end of a
– Well, I'll tell you what I – this was one of my favorites, and it's a little different than that, but was that there was a bill for cancer insurance. You could just get health insurance for cancer, one ailment that, of course, people were quite fearful of. And what would happen is – There were, at the time, especially, particularly female legislators who had been nurses, and they really guided health policy at the time. And they got together at the end of the legislative session, and they were up against some very powerful forces, and they beat that bill. And it was really beautiful to see, to see that here are these, nurses, because, you think of legislature as lawyers and a lot of retired people and – But they banded together, didn't matter what party, which party, and they beat a bill like that in the last few days, and it was great. It was early in my tenure in the legislature, and I learned a lot of lessons from those. And I'm thinking of Norma Guile, especially, who was from Western Connecticut, and there are people in the legislature who are real free operators in certain arenas, and it's the way it should be.
Colin, last 30 seconds?
Yeah, I mean, I still haven't recovered last year from glass eels, you know, which is a really terrible bill. And I mean, this is a species that is perched on the lip of extinction. But so it's like passing a bill that allows you to shoot whooping cranes. But because it's 11:45 at night and they need, you know, I can't remember what it was. It was fracking. Who knows what it was? They need it. So it's like, oh, okay, they can shoot whooping cranes, you know, whatever. So last year was glass eels. God only knows what it'll be this year.
We can't wait to see what it's going to be. This legislative session. Governor Malloy's budget address comes up later today at noon, and we'll have complete coverage tonight on the rebroadcast of The Wheelhouse. That will actually be a special budget edition of The Wheelhouse tonight. Thanks so much to Kevin Rennie, a columnist for The Hartford Current, for joining us. Thanks so much, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock, The Colin McEnroe Show, where you'll be talking about corruption. Thanks, Colin.
Thank you, sir.
Our program produced by Tucker Ives, Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor, Heather Brandon. Our executive producer, Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.